Welcome to episode 185 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Jonathan Layton. Jonathan is an ethics strategist, writer, social change advocate, and public speaker. He's executive director of the Organization for the Prevention of Intense Suffering, or OPIS, a Swiss-based think and do tank that promotes the prevention of human and non-human suffering as our overriding global ethical priority. His first book, The Battle for Compassion, Ethics in an Apathetic Universe, explores one of our big questions, what matters? And his new book, The Tango of Ethics, Intuition, Rationality, and the Prevention of Suffering, goes further in proposing a rigorous reassessment of how we think about the basics of ethics. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 184 others in our timeless back catalogue. Why not let me know via review or rating? Reviews and ratings and sharing with friends really help more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate and rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for the word Sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in any of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these sorts of ideas, not just sentientists. And one of our current community projects is working to get the Sentientism worldview into education curricula around the world. If you'd like to find out more or help make that happen in your country, please get in touch at hello@sentientism.info via one of our online groups, or just message us online. Thanks for listening.
There are various things I disagree with about classical utilitarianism, and one of them is just this idea that happiness and suffering can balance each other out. To put everything onto the same sort of numerical scale or use the same numerical tools without recognizing that we're talking about two different modes of being. Would you be willing to exchange places with an animal in the wild? Or is your perspective based on the privilege of having been born a human on this planet in a part of the world where, you know, you're much less likely to suffer? How do we help governments to become more responsive to the needs of their constituents? And when I say constituents, I mean it in the largest sense, you know, not just the humans who have voting rights, but all sentient beings who are affected by the government's actions.
Sentiocracy, maybe.
Sentiocracy, yeah.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
Good, Jamie. I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you. Really good. It's wonderful to get the chance to talk to you because you're another one of my guests I've been in touch with for a while, but it's been very sporadic and very online. But I looked it up. You were a member of our Sentientism Facebook group since 5 years now. So I think you're one of the first to join the group. So it's wonderful to get the chance to have our first proper conversation. So welcome.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Really appreciate your inviting me to your podcast.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to have you here. So, and as you know, this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the most fundamental philosophical questions and the most important, the questions of how should we understand the universe and what's real, questions of epistemology, and just as importantly, the questions of what matters and who matters, the central questions of ethics. And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really pluralistic, simple, but also radical worldview called sentientism, which suggests that when we think about the what's real question, we should take a broadly naturalistic approach using evidence and reason, hopefully with a healthy dose of humility to try and understand reality as much as we can. And when it comes to the question of ethics, of, you know, who matters and how should we set our moral scope, the clue is in the name that every sentient being, any being capable of experiencing, should be included in a moral consideration, at least to some sort of minimal level. But I'm lucky in these conversations to talk to a dazzling range of minds, some of whom agree and some of whom don't. But one of the reasons I was fascinated to talk to you is because your work hits those core philosophical questions so hard. And your new book, The Tango of Ethics, I think chapter one includes the phrase, the path of truth and compassion, so it clearly hits epistemology and ethics directly. So yeah, looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, well, I mean, from everything you say and everything I know about you, I think we're incredibly closely aligned in our, in, well, the kinds of questions we ask and also I think in the answers that we provide. So, I mean, in some ways, a lot of what I'm going to be saying is basically, I think you'll probably be nodding your head in agreement, but yeah, maybe I have some takes on some of the issues that maybe are a little bit different or provide some additional perspectives. So anyways, I'm interested in sharing them with you and discussing.
I look forward to exploring, yeah. And for those who don't know your work already, how would you best introduce yourself and your life's work and what you do?
I sometimes struggle with that question, but just to put it briefly, I mean, I'm a scientist by training. I did a PhD in basically molecular biology. And after a little corporate path, moving myself farther away from things I actually really cared about, I found myself drawn to the big questions and essentially, you know, the key question of what matters and what do we do about it. So I would describe myself as an ethicist, not that I've done formal academic training in ethics, aside from a few philosophy courses at university. But this is basically the path that I've chosen, is to study and address these questions. So yeah, I'm the author of two books and I run a small think and do tank called OPUS, Organization for the Prevention of Intense Suffering, which is basically an extension of this work. It's an attempt to try to put the ideas into practice. So in a nutshell, that's what I do.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah. And it'll be good to come back to the work of OPUS as we think about how to make a better world, because that's exactly what you're trying to do there. So in our final question. So let's start with the first of these big philosophical questions, that question of, I almost see it as a precursor to what matters, the question of what's real and how should we understand the reality we inhabit. And for many of my guests, it's interesting to explore the sort of philosophical journey, even since childhood, in thinking about those things. How were they brought up to think about reality? Was that a spiritual or religious way of thinking, or a supernatural way of thinking? Was it more scientific or atheistic or agnostic in some sense? And how's that side of their thinking shifted over time? And obviously the question of epistemology isn't just about sort of religion and the supernatural, but quite often that's an interesting place to start, given most people are brought up with some sort of, you know, religious worldview today. What was your journey there?
I would say, I mean, my strongest influence was probably a scientific one. Several family members are scientists. I mean, my father is a physicist, and I have some uncles and cousins who are research biologists. So I definitely grew up with this respect for the scientific method, the idea of, you know, doing experiments to understand reality. And I guess you could say it's sort of a naturalistic, mechanistic way of thinking about the world. It's not that there was no spirituality at all. I mean, I grew up in a Jewish household that was more traditional than religious. And so, you know, we went to services and, you know, reciting things that I didn't necessarily understand the meaning of. I went to a Hebrew school, but it wasn't a religious one. So, you know, I think most of the other kids didn't really take very literally the kinds of things that we were being taught, you know, in terms of biblical studies and so on. I probably had a brief phase where I did take things more literally and wanted to take on board things I was being taught, but that didn't last very long. And, you know, my way of understanding the world has really been, as I said, strongly informed by the scientific perspective and basically seeing the world as inherently physical, which is obviously not to say that the subjective doesn't matter. In fact, I would say the subjective is the essence of what matters, and this is a perspective I've been trying to communicate in my books.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that's a fairly common story. Growing up in a sort of generally religious background, at least from a cultural perspective in terms of practices and ways of living and maybe some rituals and things we did together in community, but not really engaging too much with this sort of specific supernatural beliefs and eventually sort of leaving those behind completely. And it sounds like the sort of supernatural aspects, the mystical aspects, were never particularly central to you, and you sort of left them anyway. So there wasn't particularly a traumatic journey there where you had to struggle or wrestle with that stuff?
No, it wasn't. There was never this really strong tension. You know, my maternal grandfather, you know, he would go to services, of course, and it was all part of our sort of cultural life. But and I remember him describing himself as a humanist, which was basically his way of saying, you know, don't take the supernatural too seriously.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you. And that story about, I guess, religion or non-religion is one aspect of, I guess, epistemology, but also ontology, you know, what we think is real, not just how we work it out. But some people also, even if they've moved away from a religious worldview, and even if broadly they have a sort of naturalistic approach, still want to leave some space for something that goes beyond the natural, something supernatural, something transcendent, some essence of spirit or soul. Or is there any of that in your thinking at all? Or do you tend to take, you know, when people use spiritual type language, do you put that into a formally naturalistic context?
I guess the short answer would be yes. I think spirituality And this is a perspective I've developed maybe more strongly over the past several years. I think spirituality is an important part of life, but maybe the way I define it is a little bit different. But I don't think of spirituality in the supernatural sense as being a way of explaining the world outside of science. I think of spirituality in terms of the experience. The experience of feeling that there's an intense meaning possible in life. Now, to be perfectly honest, I think during spiritual experiences, we might suspend the very rational perspective. You can't really be fully plunged into a spiritual experience if you're also trying to analyze things scientifically at the same time. So I think I experience sometimes a certain suspension of disbelief. And, I'm talking about, if I want to be more concrete about this, I'm talking about, experiences where I've been sort of in circles with other people, maybe you're lighting a fire and maybe people are reciting some sort of poetry or even something more profoundly spiritual in a sense. And I go along with it and, my rational brain will still say, okay, I know how the world works, but it feels like a source of meaning at times to get into that other kind of state of mind. And I don't think there's anything dangerous about it as long as we, as long as we don't question the scientific basis of everything, but we still allow ourselves to have that space to feel something larger or some sort of greater sense of connection with others. But it can be a bit paradoxical as well. And, in some sense, this relates to the theme of my new book, The Tango of Ethics, and, we can go more into that. But it's this dance between two very different perspectives on the world, which I think plays out in many ways, and specifically with respect to ethics. But I think that kind of theme of the interplay between two perspectives is very relevant to what you're talking about. How do we reconcile the need to understand reality as accurately as possible using the tools of rationality and science, and how do we also extract meaning from our existence? And there can seem to be an inherent conflict, and I think as long as we're aware of what mode we're in, there's a way of reconciling the two.
Yeah. And I love the way you describe that, sort of, like you say, in a circle around the fire, maybe with some ecstatic dance music. And it almost feels like there's two, there's at least three different ways of looking at that. One is you can insist on something that's almost scientistic and sort of says, look, we're evolved apes. The way you're feeling is just a product of your evolution and your biology and the social context and the experiences you're having and the firing of your neurons, and almost sort of crush the meaning and the fun and the joy and the value out of it. The other example is to say, no, this is such a pure transcendent thing that it is not related to physical reality at all. It is in some sense truly magical and beyond, and in a purely spiritual sense, something that's completely distinct from the real world. And I think from the way you describe it, I would agree with that, which is there's a resolution of those two, which is that even our subjective experience is part of objective reality, and it's a deeply important part. And I think we probably share this view that subjective experience is how you get to the what matters thing, but you don't have to deny physical reality to see the value in that. And you also don't have to pretend there's something magically distinct either, right? The subjective is ultimately part of the subjective universe we all share. And so I think you can enjoy that experience around the fire at the same time as not having to believe in magic to see that and feel a value in it. But
yeah, I totally agree with you. There's this idea that you can entirely describe reality using mathematical equations. And I think that view is flawed in that, yes, you can predict, to the extent that things are predictable, you can predict the, the future positions of and characteristics of particles, a certain way into the future using the tools of science. You can make sense of the motions of particles on small scales and larger scales and so on. That doesn't tell you everything that there is to know about reality, because subjective reality it exists on a whole different level. And so it's determined by the positions of those particles. So in theory, if you have two identical, entirely identical physical situations that both produce subjective experience, and you know what the subjective experience is in one, you'll be able to know what it is in the other. But you won't actually know what it's like, what the actual experience is like, unless you've actually experienced it yourself. Subjective experience and the nature of the experience in all its intensity and diversity is, you know, in some sense, I would argue that is not the essential nature of reality. I would say it's the most important part of reality. In fact, I would say it's the only part of reality that really matters when it comes down to ethics. What is it actually like for sentient beings to experience the world?
Yeah, which is the perfect segue to our second question about what matters. And even the intersection is quite interesting, because there are some people who will insist that there is this unbreachable chasm between, you know, the is of epistemology and ontology and the physical world and the ought of ethics and morality and value and so on. And it sounds to me like I'd be interested to know if you think there is such a chasm and you're building a bridge across it using the subjective experience, or how do you think about that view that these are completely distinct areas?
The way I think about ethics is I explicitly tried to avoid the use of traditional moral language. And I make a clear case for that in my new book. I try to get away from the use of terms like ought and should, and even things like responsibility. I mean, no, I think we can use all of these terms, and we can use the term responsibility, but, you know, things like permissible and right and wrong. I try to avoid that kind of moral realist framing altogether. And the reasons are pretty straightforward. I think that, first of all, I try to take a very naturalistic view of approach to ethics. I think in terms of subjective experience and phenomenology, and I try to make descriptive statements, things that we can truthfully say about subjective experience. I think that more framing things in a moral realist sense it's basically an application of old ways of thinking about ethics that have been handed down over the years. And these are also very strongly hardwired into our way of thinking about the world, because we have very strong moral intuitions which have served us in an evolutionary sense. And by the way, in my book in general, it's not just moral realism that I try to avoid, but it's other assumptions that have, I think, been built into ethical thinking, which I challenge and try to build up a new approach to ethics starting from scratch. And I'm not saying that these are all of my own ideas, but I try to challenge all of these assumptions, which are often, I think, unquestioned. So this whole way of thinking that ethics is about what we ought to do, it already influences the whole way of thinking, in that it suggests that there are things we ought to do. There is an objective idea of right and wrong. And what I argue is that when we use these terms, we often think we mean something larger or more meaningful than the meaning that these terms really have. And that when we use these terms, it often maps onto something much narrower. You know, this is my own idea, the various terms used for how the words ought and right and wrong should be thought of. I mean, just to go through them very quickly, you know, there's the idea that these are emotions. You know, when we say that something is right or wrong, we're expressing our how we feel about an action, which I would say, you know, is more than just liking or not liking, but, you know, there can be a very strong sense that something is right or wrong, because it taps into our emotions, but our intuitions, that there is something objective to be right or wrong. Or it can be more in a prescriptive sense. We want people to act in a certain way, so we tell them, you know, this is the right thing to do, or this is the wrong thing to do. Or, you know, two other potential meanings are that, you know, a certain way of acting is the most reasonable, most aligned with rationality and compassion. And then maybe a more precise way that it can be used is that acting a certain way is in alignment with a certain moral framework. So these are some of the ways that I think we use these words. And I think that in philosophy, I think it's not always, there is a tendency to use these words in this sort of loftier moral sense, this loftier objective sense of morality with a big M. And
we sort of reify these things. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I mean, so getting back to your initial question, it's not even that I'm trying to bridge the is with the ought. I'm trying to say, well, what can we say about certain phenomenological states? So the starting point is subjective experience, because without subjective experience, there's nothing for anything to matter to. And then what can we say about different kinds of subjective experience? I don't know if I'm sort of jumping ahead in what you wanted to talk about, but I make a distinction between subjective experiences that there is an urgency to change and subjective experiences that there's no urgency to change.
And that's from the perspective of the being having the subjective experience.
Exactly. And this is what makes suffering unique. Suffering is a state of being that inherently calls for action. I mean, if whether the action can be external or by the being that is experiencing it, there's an aversiveness. This is an inherent need to change that state. This is what makes suffering unique, that other states like happiness, you know, if we just even just thinking in terms of the hedonism and the two poles of happiness and suffering, this is what makes suffering distinct from happiness. I mean, we can talk more about this if you like. This is really central to the kinds of ideas I'm advocating for.
Yeah, thank you. And because it's interesting, when some people want to challenge the idea of moral realism, for some that leads them towards a sort of nihilism, a sort of recognition that in a sense, nothing really matters, right? It's all just physics churning away and there's no inherent meaning to that whatsoever. And you don't follow that path because you ground meaning in subjective experience, right? Which is a phenomenon. It is a naturalistic thing that really does exist. But that's, I guess, your grounding of why anything matters is because things matter to the subjective being. And it's also interesting that you wanted to take a sort of descriptive approach, because some people who really want to take a descriptive approach, and again, a naturalistic approach, will look at, you know, evolutionary psychology, they'll look at group dynamics, they'll look at sociology and psychology, and they'll come up with a purely descriptive understanding of, you know, how human minds work when we're thinking about concepts like right and wrong and good and bad, and they'll talk about emotions and intellect and so on. But in a purely descriptive stance, some of those people end up giving up on normative ethics completely, because they're just like, well, humans are what humans do. You know, if this particular group over here has agreed amongst themselves that these set of norms are moral and right, then, you know, who are we to judge from outside, right? Just let's just describe how that group have come to that view, and we can do no more. We cannot judge it from outside, even if that group might be causing egregious suffering to the subjective experiences of people within that group or outside. But again, I think it feels like you've avoided both of those paths by this grounding in subjective experience. And
so, yeah, I think I can say a couple of things about this. First of all, different states of being matter, and some states matter more than others. So when there's suffering, there's something, it intrinsically matters to change the state of suffering, you know, especially, you know, extreme or unbearable suffering. So to say that nothing matters because morality, or because moral realism is a false approach, in my view, I would say that's just an entirely false implication.
Because the suffering in itself is intrinsically bad to the sufferer.
Right.
I mean, because I think I put it in slightly different terms from you, because I know you want to try and avoid these terms, but in a way, I'm quite comfortable drawing a pretty direct link between the good and bad of experience and the good and bad of morality.
Okay. So I do make a distinction there. I make a distinction between the state and the action. And it's basically for the reasons I gave. I think we can make clear statements about whether a state is good or bad. And you know, I from an ethical perspective, I would really focus on the bad, because I think of, you know, the good, you could say that the good might be the absence of the bad. There is this fundamental asymmetry, I would argue, between suffering and happiness. So I would really focus on the bad and trying to alleviate the bad. Let's say that the state of suffering is bad in itself. But then when we try to judge actions as being right or wrong, or, you know, this is the good action or this is the bad action, I think we're on shakier ground. And I think we could fall into this sort of trap of moral realism again. And this is something I try to avoid. Having said that, And what I wanted to add on to what I was just saying before is that I think we can ground everything not in more realism, but in rationality itself. So we can talk about whether actions are rational or not. So I like to use this grounding in rationality and compassion, which I think, you know, if you combine rationality and compassion, you have the essence of ethical or moral thinking. In fact, you could argue that compassion is rational. So you could, I would argue in theory, just start from rationality. And that will lead you not just to evidence-based actions, but also to compassion in the sense of taking actions to alleviate and prevent suffering. And that just stems from the awareness of the reality of suffering and the fact that others' suffering matters as much as one's own. So once one, you know, this is also comes from an understanding of personal identity, you know, the reality of personal identity and the fact that our view of it is of it being something continuous and stable over time and separate from others, that's all an illusion. When you take that understanding of personal identity into account, that automatically leads to a concern for all suffering and not just one's own.
Is there a risk in that line of thinking where, which is quite common in, among many worldviews, where you recognize maybe the self is an illusion and that by stepping away from the self, there's a risk you lose concern for the individual, the subjective being that is experiencing? Everything is one. We are all an experiencing entity. Again, it's almost like an echo of the hardcore physicalist nothing matters because we're just all operating and I don't really exist and you don't really exist. And if you don't really exist, how can I harm you?
Well, I think even if you take the perspective on personal identity, the idea that a personal, distinct personal identity is an illusion, that doesn't mean we don't exist. It doesn't mean that we physically don't exist. It doesn't mean at all that our experiences are not real. It's just in terms of identity itself and the illusion of separation from one another. But, you know, you raise an interesting point about, you know, how do we reconcile these different perspectives on identity? And I devote a section of that, of my book, to that, on, let's say, the coexistence of these different theories of personal identity. So just to go through them very quickly, I mean, there's the sort of classical intuitive view of personal identity, which has been termed closed individualism. That's just the way we normally think about ourselves and others as being sort of the discrete entities that, you know, go through life and are unchanging. And you know, when you do thought experiments, that view of personal identity brings you to paradoxes. And it's not a view that's entirely compatible with the physical world. And to avoid these paradoxes, you know, we need to think a little bit more loosely about personal identity and think more in line with the Buddhist perspective. And so there are two other ways of thinking about personal identity that are sort of established, and that is empty individualism and open individualism, which are sort of, they sound very different, because empty individualism says that we're all just basically slices of consciousness moments, and open individualism, like you were saying before, is basically this idea that we're all one. But I don't think they're in conflict with one another. I think they're just two ways of looking at the same issue. And these open individualist perspectives, they sort of coexist with the closed individualism perspective, which is how we sort of instinctively go through life and think of one another as being, you know, separate individuals. And somehow we need to reconcile both perspectives, because we can't have a really universally applicable framework for thinking about ethics that ignores the reality of personal identity. You know, otherwise that framework will be based on some sort of an illusion. At the same time, a workable framework of ethics that actually feels intuitive, that is applicable to our everyday lives, has to recognize that closed individualism is where we drive a lot of the meaning in our lives. The attachment that we have to individuals who have a very strong role in our lives, you know, the love we feel for other individuals, you know, we think of them as individuals. We don't think of them as consciousness moments. And I would say that the coexistence of these two very different perspectives on reality and of ourselves and others, it's another facet of the tango. And this is what I love so much about the tango metaphor, is that I think it goes to the heart of some of the paradoxes that we're faced with in ethics. There are often two very distinct modes of being that are both relevant, but cannot be put on the same level or treated with the same tools. And there is this kind of vague dance between them. And it's not that one wins over the other. There's this interplay between these two ways of looking at the world. And any framework of ethics that is, you know, that we can really apply needs to incorporate these two modes of being.
And I think it's a fascinating way of putting it, because you can see that. I mean, I'm not a proper philosopher, right? But I read a lot of it and I'm fascinated. But that interplay is very often there. You can feel that there's, you know, people driving for a rational approach to moral philosophy, but then feeling the pull of their intuition as a check or a break, or people driving for a more intuitive approach to moral philosophy and then using rationality as a check. So in a way that dance is going on, but I think it's very distinctive to recognize that dance is the point, right? It's not about one side winning over the other and us crushing our intuition or us just overriding rationality. You know, that's part of the wonder of this topic is that dance and that interplay, and recognize them as distinct, as you say, distinct levels in our thinking.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that it's sort of like a trap that some philosophers or people thinking about philosophy can fall into, is especially the desire to take a very rationalistic approach that basically, you know, like I was saying, tries to incorporate everything, the rationality and the intuitions, into one coherent framework that uses the same tools. And, you know, I can give you a very specific example, which is something that, you know, I've engaged with, which is, you know, classical utilitarianism, which is, I guess utilitarianism is not, let's say, that popular in the larger world, but it is particularly powerful among, you know, people trying to focus on impact, you know, as, including within the effective altruism movement that, you know, that I'm in many ways aligned with. What I've seen is that, there are various things I disagree with about classical utilitarianism, and one of them is just this idea that happiness and suffering can balance each other out. This perspective, which, you know, has roots going back a couple of hundred years, ultimately it's based on this desire, to be able to put everything onto the same sort of numerical scale or use the same numerical tools. And without recognizing that we're talking about two different modes of being, and that the desire for happiness and meaning exists on a different level from the need to alleviate suffering.
They're not just opposites of each other or negatives of each other. They can be netted out. They're distinct. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's this deeper underlying, I would say, perspective that I think a lot of people don't feel comfortable thinking about is actually questioning the value of existence altogether, you know, which can seem extremely nihilistic. And I think this is part of the problem with a lot of moral philosophy, is that there's this almost sort of jumping in into the middle, taking on board all the sort of the assumptions that are already sort of baked into a lot of moral philosophical thinking without actually putting them into question, which is, you know, a point I was making earlier.
Your criticisms of classical utilitarianism are interesting because, in a sense, from already what you've said, you focus on, I guess, the subjective experiences, you know, if you want the sentience, the consciousness of beings as being the sort of core of ethical grounding and what matters. And in a sense, that is a type of consequence, which might lead you into consequentialism as a sort of way of thinking about morals and ethics. We're ultimately concerned in some way with the outcomes of things we do and the actions we take and so on and so forth. And then utilitarianism, I guess, is probably the foremost amongst those, you know, consequentialist ways of thinking that, as you said, in various forms, thinks about well-being or suffering or different states and address them. And I think that your criticism of that sort of ability to net and offset is a really powerful one, because I think many people find that disturbing, you know, whether it's the idea of the gladiators in the Colosseum, right? Obviously, there's terrible suffering on the ground, but if 100,000 people enjoy it, or if 5 million people watch it on YouTube and enjoy it, you know, when you put it in the spreadsheet, everything's fine, surely, right? So that's a really important, central criticism of yours. But there's another interesting dynamic, I think, that's going on with utilitarianism, because on the one hand, this is the question we'll come to next, I think it's very good at forcing us to adopt a much broader moral scope, because it says, look, all well-being matters. It doesn't matter who is experiencing that well-being. Everybody does, right? It sort of pushes us towards a much more point of view of the universe, and a rational, a more neutral perspective. But there's also a risk, and this is one of the reasons people criticize utilitarianism in general, is that they think, okay, well, that's great. You've broadened our moral scope. We've now taken this sort of weird godlike perspective of the universe, but in so doing, we've now become disconnected from and maybe even dispassionate about the actual subjective lives that are undergoing the suffering, right? And now you seem like someone who's sitting behind a spreadsheet calculating things in some awfully brutal way. Where's the care? Where's the compassion? Where's the engagement with the individual? And in a weird way, some flavors of utilitarianism are sort of doing what you were talking about earlier on with the personal identity approach, because they're almost saying, actually, the individual subjective beings don't matter. They're really just sort of containers of utility. They're containers of experience. And that leads some utilitarians into this offsetting idea where, yeah, you might be suffering over there, but this person is benefiting, so it's fine. Whereas I'm like, you can't offset one individual subjective being's subjective experience. But it's weird because the utilitarian approach to that feels quite brutal and modern and Eurocentric, whereas the softening of personal identity comes from, you know, more Buddhist, you know, Eastern way of thinking. But in a way, there's a risk of depersonalization maybe in both. I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, utilitarianism has some very attractive aspects and some potentially less attractive aspects, as you were saying. This idea of, say, cause neutrality, or the idea that every locus of experience matters regardless of where it's located in space and time, is an extremely important aspect of utilitarianism. It's basically taking a neutral approach. It's removing, in a sense, it's removing the observer, or it's removing a sense of specialness from the observer and saying that, you know, wherever you have experience, that's worth considering, you know, even if it happens far into the future. I think one of the big issues, though, is this idea that you can just sort of balance out happiness and suffering as if they're pluses and minuses. And, you know, this is something, this was actually one of the initial motivations for me to write my book, The Tango of Ethics. And this started, you know, quite a few years ago after my initial interactions with effective altruists, some of whom I was very aligned with, and others who had this idea that, you know, any amount of suffering can, in principle, just be balanced out.
I guess there's two distinct things here. One is, can you offset the suffering and the well-being of two different beings? And the other one is, can you offset the suffering and the well-being of an individual being? Because one, I guess, is offsetting suffering versus well-being, and the other one is multiple beings, you know, being aggregated. Are you rejecting both, or?
Part of my answer is to be very precise about what we mean by offsetting. So individuals will undergo some suffering in order to have future happiness. And there are a couple of things going on. First of all, to a certain extent, that suffering might be voluntary if it's, you know, based on decisions that are taken willingly. And there's something different about voluntary suffering compared to involuntary suffering. So there's, just by its very nature, the suffering might be different. The other aspect is that there's personal autonomy involved, which is something that we allow people to undergo suffering themselves, again, if, you know, if it's voluntary. But the trade-offs that people make for themselves, you know, this is going on within one individual brain that is sort of making the calculations for itself and is prepared to put up with the with the consequences of its reasoning. When you apply it to two different individuals, we're talking about very different phenomenology. We're basically talking about imposing involuntary suffering on some so that others can reap the benefits. And the whole experience of that suffering in an individual is going to be very different because they don't experience it as a voluntary trade-off. You know, it's a fundamentally different phenomena. So yeah, this idea of going from the intrapersonal to the interpersonal, I think, is just fundamentally flawed. And then, you know, just this whole idea that suffering and happiness are somehow symmetrical. Again, I would argue against it just from this view of urgency. You know, what situations do we need to change? This also relates to the concept of tranquilism, which was written about in an essay a few years ago by Lucas Glure, which basically says that, you know, when there's no suffering, there's no problem. It's a very Buddhist approach to to thinking about reality. Whereas, you know, when there's happiness, there's no need to change it. But not only that, if there's emptiness, there's no need to change that either. So, you know, I sometimes use the example of a barren, rocky planet in some sort of distant solar system. There's no inherent need to fill that planet with life. It's something, when people want to do it, that comes from an urge that they have themselves. But it's not an urge. It's an urgency that is inherent to that, that lifeless planet. But somehow there's this idea of happiness having value that exists in the same way that suffering has disvalue. And it's a very intuitive, strongly intuitive notion. It's only when you start dissecting it and think, what do you actually mean by value? Where's this need to increase value? And if you start raising those questions, then your whole idea of what value means, and I wish more people would stop to think about where is this urgency to create positive value in the universe, which doesn't mean that we can't do it. It doesn't mean that it's not something we might feel is worthwhile. It just doesn't exist on the same level as the urgency of doing something about suffering. And this is why the framework that I'm proposing, it basically tries to reconcile these two different perspectives, the very sort of detached perspective that sees suffering as something inherently bad that needs to be addressed and changed and eliminated if possible, and then the very human desire to exist, to thrive, to derive meaning and to further its own existence. And again, this is, these are two aspects. These are the two maybe essential aspects of the tango that I talk about. And I think that's a very honest way of looking at our situation as human beings who have these very strongly hardwired desires, even though they've been built into us through the process of evolution, but it's still essential to who we are as human beings. And then this more detached, objective perspective that says, well, look what evolution has done. Evolution has created all the suffering that didn't ask to be created. And it's just there because it's been useful for Darwinian processes. And, what can we do to try to improve things? So two different, very different perspectives. I would say, I think of it as the human and the ancient. And there is this tango between them to try to, that we're sort of forced into. We're forced into dancing this tango in order to live meaningful lives and still have an effect on the world.
Yeah, thank you. And so it's clear that your view recognizes the value in happiness and positive experience, but because of the direct and obvious imperative to alter a state of suffering, it leads you to prioritize suffering and particularly extreme forms of suffering. And as you hinted at earlier on, some people, when they focus on suffering and negative experiences, and I guess negative utilitarianism is one, response to that, is to prioritize the downside more heavily in someone's utilitarianism, that can lead people to a stance where they, just on this planet, look at the sheer scale of suffering, human and not, and come to the conclusion it would be better if there was no subjective experience, no sentient experience, no humans whatsoever. And there are obviously philosophical fields of thought around varieties of antinatalism, for example, and more extreme versions of that that ultimately would aim to, per the sort of Thanos snap, isn't it better just to end this all? And ultimately the view that a valueless universe would be better than one with enormous negative value. How do you think about sort of antinatalism and those sorts of other varieties of negative focused thinking?
I think it's an entirely valid perspective to say that, there are huge amounts of extreme suffering going on the planet at this very moment. And there have been for hundreds of millions of years. And to say that one wouldn't have willingly created this situation from scratch, and I talk about this in my book, I say that, I give a metaphor, a bunch of engineers designing a new car, and they want it to just have all the best, the most amazing characteristics that you would want in a vehicle. And they find that the only problem is that, every million or 10 million miles, the car spontaneously explodes. And they think, okay, well, we better get this right before we put it on the market. You can think of it in a similar way that, yes, there's a huge amount of beauty in the world and meaning, and you know, some people are fortunate to experience much more of that than others. But you wouldn't, if you're really aware of all the different kinds of experiences that would come into being, you wouldn't necessarily design a world the way it is right now. I mean, if you were really aware of what all that extreme suffering meant, you would say, okay, well, maybe we can improve things before we go live. I think that's a pretty honest perspective, especially if you're really willing to confront the reality of what the suffering is and not just think of it as something sort of abstract or nebulous. But you know, we already live in the world that we didn't choose the world as it is. We were born into this world. And so the question is, what are reasonable approaches that we can take to respect our intuitions to the extent that they are somehow essential for living and for continuing to live as sort of normal human beings, if you like, and also doing whatever we can to confront the reality of the suffering and do something about it. And just because we wouldn't have chosen the world to exist as it is doesn't mean that there's any kind of obligation to try to, you know, take destructive steps and blow the world up. You know, I mean, there are all kinds of arguments against that. And by the way, you know, taking a moral non-realist approach also allows you to say that, you know, there's no obligation to take any kind of step like that. You know, we can also respect our intuitions that say, you know, we want to live, we don't want to self-destruct, we want to continue to survive. That gives you a certain amount of leeway instead of having to say, oh, well, the framework says suffering bad, so the best way to get rid of suffering would just be to just destroy everything. There's no obligation. I mean, even the term obligation, you know, that's what I was saying from the beginning. I don't think in those terms. An ethical framework that is meant to be applicable needs to be pragmatic, needs to appeal to people's intuitions, you know, and that means not proposing overly radical steps, but still asking people to confront reality, not to close their eyes and say, okay, well, you know, it's a complicated place where we live, this world, and there's probably a lot more suffering going on than most people are willing to admit or look at. You know, we have technology at our disposal, and what are the ways that we can use the technology to reduce as much of that suffering as possible? You know, it's not in theory, it's not an insolvable problem. You know, we can maintain existence and actually create a flourishing future if we use technology correctly. And so I think the real challenge is getting more people to care about suffering in addition to just survival.
Yeah, I mean, I like that approach. And again, if you think, if many people look with horror the way humanity writ large has used our power, certainly with respect to non-human sentient beings and often to each other, but there's sort of a weird perverse hope in there as well, in that there is a potential for us to radically change our role with respect to wider sentient kind, to deploy that power in very, very different and responsible ways. So, you know, there's some hope there too. Yeah, thank you. Well, we should probably come on to the next big question of who matters. And one of the interesting things about the sort of what matters conversation is that, given the deeply embedded anthropocentrism that we all swim in, many people could have listened to everything you've said, or most of what we've said through this conversation, and been nodding happily along and agreeing completely with our approach to morality and ethics, on the assumption that we were only talking about humans, human subjective experience and human suffering and so on. What's your journey been when you come to think about moral scope and who gets to matter? And again, it'd be interesting to know, I guess, how you grew up as a child thinking about intuitively who should matter in a moral consideration, and how has that aspect of your thinking shifted over time?
Well, it shifted a lot because I don't think I particularly cared about animals when I grew up. I mean, no more than any other kid. You know, you like dogs and cats and you don't think about the food on your plate. It took a while for that to evolve. You know, I can't claim that I, you know, went vegetarian or vegan when I was a teenager, you know, nothing like that.
Took me decades. So,
you know, I guess we all have our own journey and we're exposed to whatever experiences we're exposed to.
And it's never completely over either. So,
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, when my first book came out in 2011, I hadn't gone vegan yet, even though I was, I was well aware of the suffering of animals. I talked about it in the book. It took me another year after the book came out, I think, until I made the first step to go vegetarian. And then a few months later, after meeting some effective altruists in Basel, who asked me if I was vegan and, encouraged me to try it out. And, then it was basically it was a journey in one direction. I kind of sensed I wasn't going to go back.
And what were the transitions like? I mean, socially, practically, again, just because of the environment, social environments we live in, some people just, it's like a light goes on and they do it and they never look back. And other people, it's more of a challenge. It can sometimes be analogous to, almost leaving a religious worldview for some people. It's a real struggle.
Yeah, I think the only real struggle for me was just to a certain extent, at the beginning especially, just sort of giving up things that I was so used to eating, because we have an emotional attachment to certain kinds of foods. They're part of our culture. We like the feel of certain kinds of foods in our mouth. I think having thought about this strongly and having already written a book about it, I already had a pretty strong rational sense for why this was a necessary step.
Yeah, I mean, people could quote your own book at you, so.
I mean, basically, I wanted to live consistently with the kinds of ideas I was talking about. And so I could say I should have done this sooner, but that doesn't change anything. But there was a sense of wanting to live in alignment with the actual ethics I write about. And then once you make the transition, then you think, why didn't I do this earlier? And in terms of, any kind of social ostracism, I didn't really experience that, I would say, virtually at all. I mean, I think maybe the only frustration sometimes is explaining to people and wishing other people would get on board, because it seems like the arguments are just, why would you contribute to the torture of animals?
Particularly given most of the people you're talking to already agree in theory with your arguments. That's the deep frustration. It's weird, isn't it? It's like,
I mean, nobody wants animals to suffer. I mean, I keep thinking back to one hike I was doing with a German friend of mine who was vegan. We were somewhere in the mountains in Switzerland, and I hadn't yet gone vegetarian or vegan, and I was arguing with him about dairy, and he was trying to explain to me how cows, even the harvesting of milk from cows is a cruel process, and I was sort of pushing back because maybe I didn't want to see it, or I didn't want to acknowledge it, but the arguments he made definitely stuck with me, and it wasn't that long afterwards that I went fully vegan. So yeah, so no, I was just bringing that up to say that, there's a certain resistance. We don't, if we know that a certain argument, that accepting a certain argument will force us to change our habits, if we want to be consistent with our beliefs, there's a resistance to accepting those arguments. It's, we don't want to live with cognitive dissonance. Perhaps, I mean, I can speak for myself. I think I probably needed to prepare myself for that transition, knowing that once I really took those arguments fully on board, I was going to be compelled to go vegan if I wanted to be consistent. Yeah, I mean, I think I as I was saying, I don't find a particular. I find people are very accepting, and I just wish sometimes more people would take the arguments on board and make the transition themselves.
Yeah, yeah, and when we think about moral scope, that obviously that step to, in a way, it's weird because yes, we swim in an anthropocentric, brutally anthropocentric culture generally in many places around the world. And even those places that live in a sort of more ecocentric culture that maybe are more connected to nature and see humans as part of nature rather than above nature still often find ways to justify, human exploitation of non-humans, even if it's not necessary. But at the same time, almost every human already goes beyond anthropocentrism, right? Whether it's companion animals or charismatic wild animals or there's already chinks in the armor there where people recognize that at least some non-human sentient beings matter. But as you've said, the big steps are to recognize the moral salience of animals in our labs and particularly in farms and fisheries, given how normalized those industries and those practices are. So that is a big step. But it's interesting because that isn't the only step either. And veganism technically is a stance against the human exploitation and harming and killing of animals, something I wholeheartedly support. But it's focused on the ending the human exploitation. It's not doesn't necessarily say anything about animal suffering more broadly, and that's the suffering of animals within our control, but it certainly doesn't extend to a view with regard to wild animals. So for you, and you, then you'll find a really interesting array of views amongst vegans and animal advocates. So some will say, look, they are understandably so skeptical of humanity's role in the world with regard to other sentient beings that their only aim is to end human caused exploitation and suffering. And to go beyond that in any way, even with good intentions, is hubris and dangerous and interventionist. And for God's sake, humans, just get back in your box and stop doing the bad stuff, right? Others, their veganism, like me, is motivated ultimately because my sentientism is because I have a compassion for all of those other sentient beings. And that leads me to be vegan and want to end the human caused exploitation, suffering and killing. But that's not enough for me either. I want to have compassion for every sentient being, whether or not they're being exploited by humans. And that might leave me radically uncertain about what the hell to do about that. But what's your, because I know you've written about wild animal suffering and those topics, what's your stance on those topics?
Well, I totally agree with you. And there's a parallel even to just how we look at human suffering. I mean, some people take a very sort of oppression-based approach. You know, the oppression is the key word. We need to end the oppression of some humans by other humans, which I totally agree with. But you know, that's not the end of it. It's not just what humans do to other humans. It's what humans allow to happen to other humans. That's why I think a suffering-focused perspective is broader and more universal. The question is, you know, how do we think about our connection with the rest of the world and with nature? This idea of hubris of trying to interfere with nature. I mean, I understand that perspective, and I think it's not an entirely invalid perspective, because we've seen how much, you know, where human hubris can lead. The real question is it possible to do something about it? You know, and I think hubris can be, we can interpret as hubris the idea that, you know, let's just go muck around in nature and do things that we don't understand and risking making things even worse. I think actually a lot of people who agree that, you know, suffering of animals in the wild does matter intrinsically, their biggest concern is that we'll just kind of go in there and try to change ecosystems and you know, do all sorts of horrible kind of interventions that might be well-meaning, but will just do far more harm than good. And, you know, I'm not in favor of sort of free-for-all, but I do think that to the extent that it's possible to help animals in the wild, it's just logical, because we're the only ones who can do anything about it. All of us, humans and animals, just evolved on this planet, and the, you know, what happens in the wild, it's not a pleasant sight, and just calling it the, you know, the circle of life, it's sort of a way of accepting it and not feeling that there's any responsibility. But yeah, as I was just saying, I think if there is a way for us to help animals in the wild, and you know, there are very sort of low interventionist ideas, you know, which is obviously helping animals that have been, you know, that have lost their habitat or that have been burned in you know, in fires. There are even attempts to try to vaccinate animals to protect them from disease, or potentially a way of reducing populations without the violence of actually killing them. There are more interventionist approaches, the idea of actually trying to reduce the ability of wild animals to feel pain. You know, this would be probably very controversial today, especially the way most people think of the world and think of nature. But I think if we're possible to do this in a way that's effective, I think you could argue that it would be extremely uncompassionate not to, because, you know, why does an animal being ripped apart by another animal, or, you know, suffering from the elements or from horrible diseases or parasites, why does that suffering not matter? And again, I'm not saying that we should just go in there and intervene and do whatever we want and not consider the consequences. I'm just saying that if we were able to carry out real interventions that could make a difference, then be uncompassionate not to. And, you know, it's already possible to, there's technology to do, you know, limited, say, experiments on a pilot scale. It's a difficult thing to talk about, because I mean, I know I've seen the way people's eyes can glaze over if you talk about any kind of any kind of intervention like that, because, you know, a lot of people are take a very sort of environmentalist approach and this idea that nature is sacred. And, you know, the question I would ask them is, would you be willing to exchange places with an animal in the wild? Or is your perspective based on the privilege of having been born a human on this planet in a part of the world where, you know, you're much less likely to suffer? I think as soon as we start to take this more neutral approach and be willing to imagine changing places with another being that's less fortunate, it can at least provoke a change in perspective, or at least a different way of thinking about things that will at least challenge this view that, you know, nature is sacred and whatever, you know, whatever it is should be, you know, should be sort of respected and not interfered with.
Yeah, and that's that central challenge of taking the perspective of the other, you know, imagining always imperfectly what their experience might be like, you know, has to be central to any moral approach, to my mind. So, and I'd agree. I think, one, we are already intervening in the wild at massive scale. So it's not a question about whether we intervene or not. It's already a question about how we intervene. And as you also said, there are already some, you know, small scale, low risk, quite well-proven interventions that are going on, whether it's wildlife corridors or vaccinating wild animals, which is normally done for human benefit, but it does also help reduce disease in the wild populations, or population control instead of culling. And, you know, this, there are already some very low-risk interventions that people are doing. And even in the practical, very micro sense, you know, there's a WhatsApp group for the local community around here. And if those individuals see a duck or a fox that's been injured by a car or, you know, seems to be struggling, there's an outpouring of compassion and empathy, and they will go and help. You know, there's no one saying it's just part of the circle of life, you know, stand back and watch that individual die in awful pain, right? But people, we already feel that pull, and people are already doing things on a daily basis.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm always seeing videos in my newsfeed, people rescuing usually wild animals, you know, that are at the risk of drowning or whatever. And you see, or maybe they've been caught in a fence, which is, you know, reflects, you know, the negative human impact on wild animals. But yeah, we have that capacity for empathy, and it's just it's turned on in some situations and turned off in others, and a lot of that is just very much socially conditioned, you know, based on what is considered normal behavior within our tribe. And people don't want to stand out, people don't want to be outliers, people want to respect social norms, people don't want to be considered weird.
Yeah, we're social animals, so the normal is quite often at the top of the priority, over and above ethics and morality and other considerations. Yeah, we're a strange and wondrous beast. But I mean, and on the wild animal front, I mean, where I fall back to is saying that you might be uncertain about whether to intervene or what to do, but that uncertainty is not a justification for withdrawing our moral consideration from those sentient beings. Whatever happens, we have to grant them serious moral consideration and then work out whether and what to do in the face of uncertainty. Whereas too often, and you know, I find this in the farmed animal space as well, because sometimes there's this sense of this thing is too difficult. So instead of just addressing that difficulty or working around it, I will therefore withdraw my compassion from the affected beings because of a practical difficulty. I'm like, you're confusing the implications and the practicality with a theory of moral scope and who gets to matter, and we should never undermine that, however difficult the problems might be.
Yeah, and so you know, this core philosophy that, you know, suffering, especially extreme suffering, matters wherever it occurs. You know, once that's adopted, it provides guidance to all the very different ways that we can, you know, rationally and logically care. Logically, you would care as much about digital suffering or artificial suffering.
That's another topic that's guaranteed to annoy 95% of vegans. But I would, right? If there's you know, reasonable chance that an artificial sentient being has a subjective experience and can experience suffering, then absolutely, yeah.
And in some ways, it would be less controversial to intervene because, you know, it's not intervening with nature. It's just limiting what we actually create with the technology at our disposal.
It just reminds me of what you said earlier on, where, you know, you would say, well, you know, if you were a benevolent being, you know, you wouldn't create a world like this with so much suffering. And some people are concerned that we are actually in exactly that position right now and might be quite close to creating countless trillions of artificial sentient beings that maybe could have the capacity to suffer. You know, maybe we could be in the role of a creator, an evil creator, unwitting or not.
I totally agree. I mean, it's an extremely important point. And that's why raising that question, you know, would you have created a world that contains all the suffering is an important question to ask, because, you know, just for the reason that you said, you know, we're kind of in that position now. And, you know, this probably leads to the next question. What can we do about it? And, you know, there are two aspects to it. There's the technical aspect, and whether it's possible or what would, not so much whether it's possible, but what would be the, you know, how would it be possible to create sentient beings? But then there's the sort of regulatory aspects, and more generally, there's the, what are the ethics that are governing our societies? And what do we as humanity and the governments that we elect or that are in power, what do they care about? And I think that, you know, the strongest safeguard is to have compassionate governance at a worldwide level. And I don't think the problem is simply technological. I mean, and the problem is that once something becomes possible, there's a pretty good chance of it being created somewhere, unless there's some sort of global agreement. And the global agreement will be much more likely to hold if governments are not in competition with one another. I mean, it's very complicated, because, you know, then we're talking about geopolitics, we're talking about, you know, stabilizing compassionate governance and democracy and conflict resolution. It just shows that all the problems are in some way interrelated. But if we can't deal with embedding compassion into the way our whole world is run, then we risk having these horror scenarios in the future playing out.
I think that's partly why I find your work so powerful, and also partly why I focus on trying to develop sentientism as a worldview, is because if we have this stance where we think suffering is salient and the experiences of subjective beings, sentient beings, matter, and you look at the world as it is, and we could think about potential future artificial sentience, but even the beings that exist today, you know, potentially quintillion, sextillion free-ranging animals living in the wild, you have, you know, trillions of farmed and fished animals under our control and in our labs, you have our companion animals, you have liminal animals, you have human animals with all of the intra-human conflict and ethical problems and suffering we cause each other. So one, that's a big problem for an individual evolved ape to even try and get their heads around. But there are so many problems and causes and opportunities. That's partly why it does feel like going back to some of these basics, as you put it, you know, truth and compassion, or as I put it, you know, evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient, those foundational things feel like quite deep fundamental interventions that can be robust in the face of uncertainty, and at least put us in a better position to address all of those myriad horrific problems. But and in this final question about, as you say, you know, how to make a better world, it'd be interesting if you want to delve into, you know, the work you do with Opus and so on. But I'm also interested in your sort of super big picture view, because I know you've written and thought about the concepts of compassionate governance and the ideas of, you know, getting these ideas into education, these really deeply foundational things that might be able to shift humanity's default mindset and enable us to play a radically more positive role in the future.
Well, I agree with you, and I like the way you describe it about this, you know, this need to go down to the basics and how this can represent a more robust approach. The work I've been doing with Opus, I mean, okay, it's very much work in progress, and, you know, we have ambitions to really make a difference. In the early days, or, you know, the first couple of years, we've been focusing more on very specific interventions, in a way, because, you know, the opportunities arose and they felt very tangible, and the solutions were also very tangible. I mean, talking specifically about, you know, pain relief in humans, you know, yeah, making sure that people can get morphine if they're in severe pain, people with cluster headaches should be able to get certain psychedelics that are extremely effective in relieving the pain. Working on these specific issues, I would say it's given us a little bit of a concrete foothold in addressing very specific causes, and given us maybe some credibility, because we've been advocating together with, you know, organizations and patient groups and so on. We've also been advocating against the horrors of factory farming, but we haven't had any very specific projects on that. But the idea since the beginning was really to promote the ethics themselves. to really aim high, not just to be, not to become a specialist organization working, you know, just on pain relief, which, you know, would have, of course, value in itself. But if we're really aiming to have as much influence as possible on suffering in the future, then I think we really need to take this broad approach of promoting the ethical fundamentals. And that's why, you know, I haven't lost, even when we were working on things like morphine, my goal was, you know, really to broaden our approach and try to bring compassion into politics and governance. And so more recently, we've been, you know, while we continue to advocate for things like, you know, better access to psychedelics for people with cluster headaches, just because it's, you know, such a horrible disease and it's something very tangible, and people can, you know, when people see somebody with experiencing a cluster headache and they see a video of it, they understand this matters. And governments should not get in the way of people relieving this extreme pain. And so it's a very, yeah, it's something very tangible we can talk about as an example of suffering. But the, you know, what we've been shifting towards is work on what does it mean for, what does compassionate governance actually mean? And so we're working on a guide now with a group of volunteers, basically to talk about the ethics, which, you know, I think are pretty clear, and that's been the subject of our conversation, you know, this concern for suffering and especially for extreme suffering. But what does it mean in terms of policy? You know, what are the various causes of suffering, and what are the best solutions that we're aware of? But then even at a higher level, how do we aim to embed these ethics in governance? So how do we help governments to become more responsive to the needs of their constituents? And when I say constituents, I mean it in the largest sense, you know, not just the humans who have voting rights, but, you know, all sentient beings who are affected by the government's actions.
Sentiocracy, maybe.
Sentiocracy, yeah. So, you know, the problem is huge, but I have hope, because I think there are some basic ideas that have a lot of power, and that is when people feel that their needs are being addressed, when they feel that they're being listened to, they will in turn tend to be more responsive as well. And it's something which I think is very much missing in politics and the way our world is run. And this is also something that interests me about conflict resolution. You know, we were just talking earlier about the webinar we did 2 days ago about the Israel-Palestine conflict, which, you know, it's just one specific source of suffering. But I think one of the keys is promoting this idea that, you know, let's listen to one another. Let's listen to the suffering of others. You know, it's very powerful, because it once we open ourselves to empathizing with the suffering of others, it opens others up to empathizing with our suffering. And this kind of process, I think, can lead to, you know, far greater global cooperation at the highest levels. And it's a principle that, you know, it may be hard to get governments on board, you know, especially sort of entrenched career politicians, you know, whether it's in democracies or autocratic states. But if we can spread this message among ordinary people, I think there's, and also, you know, reach, let's say, the politicians of the future, the emerging politicians, there's a real possibility to for these ideas to spread. And it's, you know, it's a difficult proposition, but I think it's a necessary one if we're going to avoid the risk of huge amounts of suffering in the future. And I think belief that it's possible is in some way self-realizing. It's maybe an intuition I have, but I think it's informed also by experience and reality, that a lot of things become possible when you believe in them. And, you know, I don't want to come across as being, you know, like overly optimistic, but I think there's a basis for believing that the world could become a much better place if we promote these ideas, and the idea that, you know, every sentient being matters.
And the potential is there, and the hope is there. I think partly because we already do this, right? Almost every human already does this, at least to some extent. You know, we can do it. And part of the reason I like the governance approach is because, and the ethics, is because these are things you can apply at almost every level of governance. They're things you can take into your life, in your, you know, your own personal life, in your family, your, you know, your local politics, the companies or the NGOs you work for, in the various different roles we have as a voter, into national politics, into regional politics, into, you know, you can imagine your ethics infusing into the UN at some point, and maybe we'll have a Universal Declaration of Sentient Rights. So I like that, because you can move things positively forward at lots of different levels. One final question I was going to ask you, and I hope this won't bring us down from the optimism, is that sometimes when you put forward what is essentially an ethical appeal, and I do this through sentientism and you're doing this through your work, it can feel a little bit like we're saying, look, can't we just be nice to each other, right? It's like peace and love and happiness. And if only everyone would agree with us, all the world's problems were solved. And I think there's actually some truth to that, right? It would actually work. But how do these approaches face up to the reality of genuine bad faith actors, sociopaths, totalitarians, fascists? You know, what when we come up against genuine bad faith actors, and I don't think there are many of them, but they seem to be able to get enormous power, how does a compassionate ethics cope with that without just being rolled over and destroyed in simple terms?
No, I mean, it's a very valid question, and it's something I grapple with as well. I guess we all sort of grapple with how do we deal with the power of totalitarian governments and huge corporations that have other things in mind besides ethics and compassion? I mean, the first thing I would say is that I think there's a real potential to harness people power. You know, it sounds very hippie-ish, but to be able to create a mass movement based on these core values, and I think there is a real potential for that. And, you know, most people are against being controlled by totalitarian governments and large corporations that just care about shareholder value. I think there is also a strategic element, which is probably very important as well. I think in a way we need to take a sort of dual approach, which is, you know, one is more at the sort of the popular level and spreading the ideas, and the other is, you know, where do we focus our energy? What are the leverage points that are more likely to be effective? You know, I take a lot of interest in the people that are thinking in terms of systems and in terms of complex systems. And, you know, for example, I watched several interviews or videos of Daniel Schmachtenberger, who, you know, I think is one of those brilliant thinkers who is able to make sense of the world in terms of the various moving parts, how they interact, and what are the you know, the essential problems that the world system, how do we define the problem and what are the potential solutions? And I think it's a lot easier to define the problem than to find what the solutions are. Because, you know, if you do think of humans as being, you know, largely, especially like, you know, the forces that are at work in the world, if you think of them as being essentially competitive, you know, from a game theoretic perspective, there's a danger that even if many actors are trying to be cooperative and compassionate, well, it takes some bad actors to ruin the whole game and, you know, and drag everyone along with them.
And I think that's probably where I land, is that to get to a a deeply compassionate approach, you have to be able to handle the defectors. And that might be unpleasant and that might be difficult. But in some situations, if you're up against, you know, someone who genuinely thinks that might makes right, right, and wants to roll over ethics for their own ends, the people who believe in a compassionate approach ultimately may have to corral more might than the people who think might makes right, because sometimes they will present us with no other choice. And even that use of, you know, force and violence, not in a retributive sense, might ultimately still be the right compassionate thing to do. But yeah, well, I guess that's the difficulty, right? We have to recognize, we have to be able to cope with defectors and bad actors in some way, and sometimes just persuasion won't cut it.
No, I think so. I think there's, you know, you can't just talk peace and love without thinking about the dynamics and the mathematics of the system that we're embedded in. The last I saw Daniel Schmachtenberger, he didn't have a solution that was ready to go, although he did hint at the idea of transparency being a potential means to solve the problem, that those that are transparent will have a greater advantage, and so we'll pull everyone towards greater transparency. At least that would maybe solve part of the problem that we're facing. But, you know, just there have been people have been thinking about this a lot more than I have, and they probably don't have any perfect solutions that are ready to go. And it's a dilemma. It's a huge dilemma to be able to take into account these various dynamics that are based on some simple aspects of human psychology and behavior, and to find some sort of stable, or at least pseudo-stable solution that will persist indefinitely and prevent things from exploding and lots of suffering occurring. It's a huge problem, but we need to be thinking strategically like that. And yeah, it's not something I've, as I was saying, it's not something I've thought about or have necessarily engaged with as much as I would like to. But I think it's an essential part of the problem that we're facing. And so I think there's a need for more of this kind of thinking and, you know, dialogue between people like, take a sentientist approach like we do, and others who are thinking more about how to maintain a stable system, who may or may not be thinking as much in terms of suffering, but probably have some aligned values. There's no way to control a complex system. All you can do is try to nudge things in the right direction. And, you know, we can hope that with some good thinking about it, we might be able to nudge things a little further. You know, hopefully that will be enough.
Yeah, well, cooperation has proved to be adaptive so far. So, yeah, hopefully we can collectively recognize we should keep doing more of it. Yeah, and as you said before, right, we do all have that. You know, there's all sorts of terrible things in the human psyche, but there's wonder and compassion and care in there too. Therein lies the hope. I think we do have a chance to radically shift our role. So, and there are wonderful people, including yourself, working on it. So.
Well, I think, you know, there's a real need for creative thinking about it. I've always thought that creative approaches really appeal to sort of our best instincts that can really resonate with people. There is a lot of opportunity, and it requires also, yeah, just the ambition to think big and to inspire people with a vision for a more compassionate world, which is, you know, I think ultimately what most people want.
Yeah, absolutely. And things can change fast if you want them to. So, well, John, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. It's so overdue. We got to have a proper conversation. It's been a real pleasure. What's the best way of people following you, learning more about Opus, buying your book, of course? I'll include links in the show notes. But
yeah. Well, yeah, thanks a lot, Jamie. It's been a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. So there's my website, jonathanleighton.org. So you can find out things I've written, and there are links to my book. To find out more about Opus, the Opus website is preventsuffering.org. Those are probably the best ways to get in contact or to find out more about the things that I've written and the projects that we're working on through Opus.
That's great. Thank you. Do you do much social media, or do you tend to steer away from?
I probably don't use it as effectively as I should, but I haven't been sucked into TikTok or anything like that.
We do have a sentientism TikTok, but don't tell my kids because we're doing it all wrong. There's no dancing. There's no music. Well, thank you again. I will let you get on with the rest of your day, Jonathan, but it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much, Jamie.
Take care.
You too.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?